Hi, it's Bonnie here. This is where we bring you all the latest news, interviews and analysis from the Evening Standard's newsroom every day at 4pm. Thanks for listening. If you like it, hit subscribe to make sure you don't miss out. Now, from the Evening Standard in London, this is The Leader. Hi, I'm Bonnie Christian. How the pandemic could create an educational underclass in London.
Children being sent home throughout the pandemic, he thinks is going to cause things to go backwards because those children were sent home without access to education, some of them.
Teach First founder Brett Wigdorts tells our education editor Anna Davis why he's worried the education gap could widen again. And
a lot of those older films really haven't aged well in terms of their depiction of women.
The Standard's Arts Commissioning Editor, Katie Rosinski, says a new wave of female directors are changing the face of horror. Taken from the Evening Standard's editorial column, this is The Leader. In a moment, fears the pandemic could widen London's education gap.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The founder of revolutionary charity Teach First has issued a stark warning. The coronavirus pandemic risks creating a so-called educational underclass in London. Brett Wigdorts says years of work to improve the life chances of the capital's most disadvantaged children risks backsliding after students were forced to learn from home and those from more advantaged backgrounds are finding it easier to recover from lost time. Our editorial column says he's right to raise the alarm.
Many pupils are still missing lessons as class bubbles are sent home after a positive test. The response must be a redoubling of the government's efforts to help children catch up, and a focus on ensuring that the $1 billion that has been allocated to do this is used predominantly to help the most disadvantaged children. Additional investment should be provided too, if evidence emerges that disadvantaged children are suffering from further misclasses. The pandemic must not be allowed to blight permanently any child's future.
The Standard's education editor Anna Davis joins me. Anna, what work has Teach First done to narrow the education gap between London's rich and poor pupils?
Brett set up Teach First as a way of training new teachers and sort of parachuting them into the poorest schools. So he got top graduates who were leaving Oxford and Cambridge, who were probably going to go on to become lawyers or city workers, to commit to working for a couple of years in teaching in deprived schools before they went on with their careers. That was the idea back in 2002. And it grew into such a massive teacher training organisation that it's become one of the biggest graduate recruiters in the country. And it's been really successful at getting sort of bright and enthusiastic, talented young graduates to work in inner city and deprived schools, many have gone on to then stay in teaching and not just do it as a teach first and then going on to other careers. So it's a different way of training, and it's a way of getting people into poorer schools. It was really successful, and then he left 3 years ago, but he he continues to be a big name in education. So the idea was to help poorer children. That was the initial idea, with inspirational teachers who would go and bring sort of fresh blood into these schools and inspire them.
So how has the pandemic affected the work Teach First has done up to this point?
I mean, the main problem is many children were just not able to work during those 6 months that they were off school for. So while they're at school, you know, whatever background they're from can be overcome, because, you know, schools do so much to level people up, you know, and give everybody the same opportunities. But then when they were sent home for 6 months, you know, many don't have a bedroom to work in or a quiet space to work in, a computer or access to the internet. So they found it very difficult to work and keep up. But then their sort of more privileged peers who did have access to all those things could continue to excel, which is why the gap has widened between those children from different types of backgrounds. And that's what Brett's really worried about, is that, you know, the pandemic has just widened this problem that was, you know, it seemed that we were getting it under control and many things had helped reduce that gap. And if nothing is done now, he worries that, we're just going to go backwards. And if you're from a poorer background, you're not going to do as well at school, which is just unfair.
Mr. Wigdorts mentions London has been a world leader in educational improvements, but now, as you say, is really worried of a backslide that will create what he terms a permanent educational underclass. What exactly does that mean?
London, maybe 15 years ago, was not seen as a great place to educate your children. But due to a number of initiatives, including Teach First and something called London Challenge, which was launched by the then Labour government to boost results in London, have actually really worked. And I've written so many times over the last few years, that the results in London are outshining those elsewhere in the country. You know, children, especially if you're from a poor background, do much better in London schools than they would do elsewhere. And that's from a combination of all those different things. And that's why he's saying, you know, when he travels the world as an education expert, you know, people really look to London as a success story. But it's this problem with children being sent home throughout the pandemic that he thinks is going to cause things to go backwards, because those children were sent home without access to education. Some of them, you know, they weren't able to do the work, and that's what he thinks, you know, could create this educational underclass of children who, you know, start off from poor backgrounds and, you know, the school doesn't help them to get out of those backgrounds because they didn't have access to all the education that they missed out on throughout the pandemic.
Did he give you a sense of how difficult it might be to reverse the impact the pandemic could have?
He was not unoptimistic. You know, I don't think it's insurmountable. You know, some of the things that the government has done, he said, haven't gone far enough. So, for example, GCSE and A-levels are being put back by 3 weeks to allow extra teaching time, so pupils can try and catch up on some of that work that they missed. He doesn't think that's gone far enough, and other things need to be done. Some head teachers have said pupils need to be given special consideration for their exam results this year if they haven't been able to work properly during the pandemic. But the main thing he's concerned about, and other head teachers, is that schools don't close again. Keeping schools open is key now, because when they're in school, they can learn and they can catch up on all the stuff they missed. And, you know, they're equal, whatever background they're from. But if you shut schools again and they go home, you know, without access to the laptops and things like that, then that's where the problems will continue.
Next.
There's always been this kind of weird attitude that somehow, I don't know, women aren't up to it.
How female filmmakers are regaining ownership over the horror genre.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets, featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow Body Set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go Facial Set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Shirley has these bouts.
She's gone sick in the head.
I read your story.
What are you doing in here?
It made me feel thrillingly horrible.
The trailer for Josephine Decker's nightmarish alt biopic, Shirley. It's one of a string of new horror films directed by women that are set to be released this year. The Evening Standard's Arts Commissioning editor, Katie Rosinski, says the genre is finally breaking away from a boys' club of directors and becoming an attractive option for women to make their debuts. And this new wave of female-led horror is playing fast and loose with the rule book. Katie joins me. You say women can feel squeamish when they're watching horrors, but for all the wrong reasons. Why is that?
Historically, the horror genre has had quite a bad track record when it comes to representing women. If you look back to sort of like classic kind of slasher horrors, it's full of female victims, depictions of quite graphic and often sexualized violence against women. You also have this trope of the final girl, who's the kind of only woman who's allowed to sort of make it out alive of this kind of massive bloodbath. Quite often that's because they've been sort of deemed to be more kind of superior or purer than their other kind of female counterparts, which kind of ties into this quite retrograde and conservative puritanical morality. That there's a lot of weird stuff around like women and sex in horror films, and I think that a lot of those older films really haven't aged well in terms of their depiction of women.
What's typically been the attitude of male horror directors when they've been asked about the lack of female directors or writers in the genre?
The male kind of gatekeepers of the genre haven't always responded to criticism of the depictions of female characters, or in fact the just general representation on screen and off of women in the genre, in particularly productive ways. As recently as 2018, Jason Blum, who's the head of Blumhouse Productions that works primarily in horror films, he was asked about the fact that his company haven't actually at that point employed any female directors, and his response was to say, well, you know, there aren't many women who are directors, and there are even fewer of them who are actually inclined to do horror films. So there's always been this kind of weird attitude that somehow, I don't know, women aren't up to it.
Historically, as you say, it's been a bit of a boys' club. Is this starting to change?
Yeah, definitely. In the past decade or so, actually, there's been this really kind of exciting new wave of female filmmakers working in the horror genre. Even recently, like just in the past few months, St. Maud, which is the debut film from Rose Glass, has been one of the most anticipated releases of the year.
When you pray, do you get a response?
Oh, it's like he's physically in me. It's how he guides me.
It's now actually number two in the box offices at the moment. It's behind Christopher Nolan's Tenet, and it's actually, you know, considering the circumstances that cinemas are going through at the moment, it's actually put in a really strong showing. Another sort of horror-esque film that's recently come out is Josephine Decker's biopic of Shirley Jackson, who is obviously, you know, this amazing female horror writer who was writing in the 40s and the 50s in the US. She's responsible for books like The Haunting of Hill House, which was adapted by Netflix a couple of years back. I wouldn't say it was straightforward horror, but it definitely plays with the conventions of the genre in kind of interesting ways.
What happens to all lost girls? They go mad.
As we see more women directors, writers and actors coming onto the scene, are we also seeing that they're taking the genre in a new direction?
Yeah, definitely. I think what's really exciting about some of those films that I've mentioned and also a couple of other recent releases is they do kind of delve into that really interesting psychological territory, or they kind of come at horror almost from a more emotional angle. At the end of the month, a film called Relic is being released. It's from a first-time female director, Natalie Erica James, and that is set in an old house with three generations of women. And it deals with topics like dementia and the burden of caring for an aging parent, as well as kind of trafficking in all these, the usual horror tropes, which, yeah, felt like a really interesting way of kind of amping up that sense of terror, because, you know, that's almost quite a universal fear, really, something like losing grip of a loved one in that way.
So what do you think makes the horror genre so attractive to female directors?
For female filmmakers, especially ones in the early stages of their career, it's a genre that has worked with quite low budgets. If you think about how kind of classic horror films build tension, create a sense of claustrophobia and isolation, it's actually quite cheap to do all of those things. Like, you don't need, you know, vast sweeping locations. You can do it all kind of on one quite small set, really. And also horror films, you know, they don't always tend to have massive stars attached to them. So in a way, especially when you consider how often female filmmakers might struggle to get filming, especially for their debut feature, a film that's cheap to make is always, you know, a pretty attractive proposition. There's also the fact that horror is quite a buoyant market for cinema goers. Like, horror fans, statistically, they spend more at the box office. They're also quite receptive to kind of new talent and new ideas. So I think those kind of practical considerations, as well as being able to like push the genre in new directions, make it quite attractive.
And that's The Leader. You can read more on those stories by picking up a copy of the newspaper or visiting standard.co.uk. Whatever you're doing this weekend, have a nice one. This podcast is back on Monday. See you then.